When I was away on sabbatical, one of the projects that I worked on was to lay out my preaching schedule through Christmas, to choose the themes and the scripture text that I was going to be using, in part to give some shape to the fall and to the Advent season, but also to give the music staff some lead time in planning and preparing the anthems for Sunday. They were very gracious about asking for that, but it was clear they had a certain amount of energy around that request. And as I thought about themes for the fall and the work that I was doing during the summer, one of the themes that I want to explore has to do with the purpose of the church, the why of church, and the church in general, capital C church, and this church in particular. That's a good time for us to pause for a moment and to look at why it is that we exist. We are down to the last few details in the punch list after this $2 million construction project that we've engaged in over the last few years. And now we can focus on the future and who we are now and where we want to go from here. In the Presbyterian tradition, there is a statement called the six great ends of the church, the six goals in the life of any church and its programs and its activities and its ministry and mission together. They are written in Presbyterianese, which I'm not even going to bother to read to you right now. I will give you the sort of the good news version, like that Bible that Susan uses with the kids upstairs. The first great end of the church has to do with sharing the good news. When you have good news to share, you share it. The second is to take care of each other. The third is to remember to celebrate God. The fourth is to preserve the truth, to discover and preserve the truth, as Mary Smith was talking about Gandhi's work, to discover your soul force. The fifth is to do justice in the world, and the sixth is to let the life within the church be an example to the world of what the realm of God might look like, what the world could be. And I'd like to spend time in these next weeks exploring all six of those great ends of the church and talk about how we live them out here at Montclair and how they might inspire our future work and help to define our mission and our purpose. So as I thought about those six themes, then the next question that I always have to deal with is, what are the biblical texts that will help us to explore that, that will elucidate those questions and those themes? And what I thought of were two texts that can move in parallel with each other. First of all, the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, which Peggy read from first of all, where it says, "You are the salt of the earth and you are the light of the world." That whole sermon is a three-chapter sermon in Matthew's gospel that talks about, that's Jesus' most concise and comprehensive teaching on how his followers are to live the life of faith, what that would look like. And I'm pairing those scriptures with text from Ephesians, from the letter, it's said to be a letter from Paul to the church at Ephesus, that's the tradition, but it's something that was actually written a little later than that and was meant to be circulated amongst all of these new-fledged Christian churches, particularly through Asia Minor, where the city of Ephesus is. And it's a letter that includes pieces of early Christian hymns and poetry and worship liturgies, and is meant to help these churches to think and to talk about the life of the church and what it means, what it looks like. It has wonderful phrases in it, like this one about how we are rooted and grounded in love, like a tree that draws its nourishment from the love of God, and how as we live together as a community of faith, how the eye of the heart becomes enlightened, that it's our hearts and our minds that are enlightened as we live together as a community. And how in this text that we heard today, Christ speaks peace to those who are far away and to those who are nearby. And one of the reasons that I was thinking of this letter, one of the reasons that I love this letter, even though it's a very complex thing to read and understand, was a story that I heard about back during the time of when people were protesting the Vietnam War. And William Stringfellow was one of these Christian activists struggling against the war in Vietnam. And he ended up having the FBI tapping his phone to hear what kinds of nefarious things he was planning as a peace activist. And so when he could tell, he could hear from the little clicks and rustles on his phone that he was being listened to at particular times. And whenever that happened, he said he would take his Bible and he would read the Ephesian letter because he said, they really need to hear this. So that's my plan in these next weeks, is for us to wander our way through the great ends of the church, accompanied by Jesus' Sermon on the Mount and the letter to the Ephesian church. So the first of the six great ends, in Presbyterianese, this is what it says: the proclamation of the gospel for the salvation of humankind. Yikes, I read that. Ooh. So many scary words in that one. At least they did change mankind to humankind at some point in the life of this tradition. But when it's like the proclamation of the gospel for the salvation of humankind. I thought, maybe I'll start with a different one. Maybe I'll start with the social justice and social righteousness one. Kind of ease into the trickier semantics and language, theological language. But then I remembered while I was away during the summer, and committees would meet, and I was included in the email of their minutes, so I could keep up on what was going on with the committees here during the summer while I was gone. And the adult education minutes, and at the bottom of one of their notes, where it talked about possible courses and possible things to explore in the education program in this church, was one little phrase that said, "And we'd like to ask Karen to talk about the meaning of the word salvation." Okay. And that might have been a plan for a class, I don't know, but it seems like something to address in a sermon. And I assumed that this request for me to talk about the meaning of the word salvation was not made because that word is considered to be so sweet and wonderful and positive that we just want to revel in its warmth and beauty for a little while. Ask Karen to talk about, bunnies or kittens or something. Salvation is a loaded word, and the gospel of salvation has not been good news all the time. The word gospel means good news, but when someone talks to you about salvation or the gospel of salvation, as many of us have experienced it out there in the culture, it's bad news. That it comes across as a pronouncement of judgment. That it's bad news, at least before it becomes good news. That the way that we hear, the question you hear when someone wants to proclaim the gospel of salvation is, "Are you saved?" And the assumed answer is usually no. And then the person will tell you how to be saved so that you can be, as happy as they are. So let me ask you a question. As we talk about this word salvation, how many of you saw the Disney movie Fantasia when you were young? Lots of people. Okay. Do you remember at the end of it, it's got the dancing hippos and it's got Mickey Mouse as the Sorcerer's Apprentice, but the very end is this two-part sequence. The first part is Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain, and the second part is Schubert's Ave Maria. So the Mussorgsky one is this very vivid music and visual images of this satanic figure and all these skeletons and things rising from their graves and being cast into the flames, and this demonic figure exulting in this damnation of all these creatures, right? Remember that one? And then there's this chiming of the Angelus bell, and it switches to the Schubert Ave Maria and this beautiful, peaceful, soft pastels of these kind of robed pilgrim figures with candles and torches moving through this beautiful cathedral-like forest with Gothic hints of Gothic arches, and it's this heaven imagery set up next to the hell imagery of Night on Bald Mountain. So I never went to church when I was a kid, and I'm not sure I would have gotten any different images than that if I had gone to church as a kid. But to me, that movie laid out my options as far as salvation was concerned. And I suspect that for many people, when the word salvation comes up, that's the imagery that springs to mind. What's going to happen to me when I die? Is it going to be Schubert or is it going to be Mussorgsky? So, now that I've completely graven those images into your brain, I want you to make them all go away. And start with a clean slate. You know, Brenda Viana sang to us last week or 2 weeks ago, imagine there's no heaven, it's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Okay, start with the clean slate. If that stuff breezes in, just let it breeze on out again. Now, let's talk about the good news of salvation. What we have is this. In the letter to the church at Ephesus, it says, Christ proclaimed peace to those far away and to those nearby, and says, here we are now, all are welcome in this place, citizens, the author says, of the household of God, sitting at the welcome table, right here, right now. There is a confidence of inclusion and welcome, confidence of Christ's peace, and confidence of God's unconditional love. That being the case, think about the question of salvation and what is it in this moment that you would ask to be saved from? Those other images get to just go away. You are loved, you are welcome, you are accepted, you are a citizen of the household of God. And now, if you look inside, what is it that you would be saved from? Besides my little alarm clock that seems to be going off. Schedules, that's one thing to be saved from. Turned off the ringer, didn't turn off the alarm. So, back to that question, and I think the list would probably include things like wanting to be freed from sorrow, from pain, from anxiety and fear, from anger, from despair. And imagine that salvation is about that. Are you saved? How can you turn, have that darkness that's in every one of our lives transformed into light? That is the good news of salvation. And one way of imagining that possibility is to say, instead of what is it that you would be saved from, ask, what is it that I would be saved for? The purpose. What is the purpose of salvation in my life and in the life of the church? What purpose would you be saved for? For the ability to give comfort and to offer hope and to claim it for yourself. The ability to have compassion and courage, to give support and strength, to offer release to the captives, including yourself. In the letter to the Ephesians, salvation comes, and it's very explicit, salvation comes through the breaking down of walls of division. We are saved as the things that separate us from one another and from God are destroyed through the activity of the Spirit of Christ. There is this cosmic, universal reunion in this letter where people are reunited with God, where people are reunited with humanity and with all of creation through the saving Spirit of Christ. The divisions go away, and new possibilities for transformation arise. I want to meditate on that image for just a moment by reading one of the greatest poems ever about the end of divisions. This is Mending Wall by Robert Frost. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll read much of it. And think of that, this is an image of salvation. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen ground swell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. No one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says it again. Good fences make good neighbors. What would your life look like if you were saved from walls of division? Like at the welcome table, gay and straight together, black and white together, young and old together, no one turned away. If you were saved from family rifts by the Spirit of Christ breaching that wall, if you were saved even from the division of life and death, that in God we are still united and nothing can separate us from that love. What if the church was able to live without division, to share, invite people to share in the gifts of leadership equally, of ordination and of marriage? Look at the society and imagine the walls coming down, walls between rich and poor, insured and uninsured, Republican and Democrat, men and women. What if all the faiths in the world were united in the Spirit of God, rather than being locked in this infernal, eternal struggle for power? What if the whole concept of enemy became a charming anachronism, where we as a human race forgot what it meant, what the word meant, like bodkin or typewriter? What if the whole concept of us and them just dissipated and drifted away in the breeze? Glenn Beck and Keith Olbermann would have nothing to talk about anymore, but they'd find something worthwhile to do, I'm sure. Does that sound like salvation to you? Or do you still prefer Schubert and Mussorgsky? Ephesians says that this is the vision upon which the church is built, this vision of salvation. This is what salvation is. Christ, the author says, is the cornerstone of this new structure, of this new dwelling for God. And the saints and the prophets and the apostles are the foundation. And I love this image. In other places in Scripture, Christ is referred to as the foundation. But here he is the cornerstone. the one perfectly shaped stone to which all the others are aligned that makes for a perfect structure. And the shape of that perfect stone is the shape of God's perfect love. All who came with him to build that foundation aligned with that perfect love. All those who worked through the millennia to build that structure of the church, to build a place that is welcoming and inclusive, including the two saints whom we lost to this church family this week, are aligned with that love, that perfect cornerstone. And all of us who are here today are part of that perfect building, that holy place which the author of Ephesians says is the dwelling place for God. We are the dwelling place for God. And that's the good news and the bad news. Because our salvation is built on love and not on judgment, it means we are not saved from pain and sorrow. Because love leaves us infinitely vulnerable. That's the good news and the bad news. Jesus himself shows us what vulnerability to loss and grief and betrayal look like and shares in that reality with us, even as his Spirit offers this new vision of salvation. The only way to be saved from sorrow is to be saved from love. And life without love, without the love of God, without the love of family, without the love of neighbor, without the love of enemy, that would be darkness. That would be hell. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. This gospel, this good news that we proclaim is a gospel of love, a gospel of inclusion, of compassion, and of peace. And that is the good news of the salvation of humankind, which we proclaim. Amen.